Thanks to donors like you, Aquinas 101 is setting the world aflame with the truth, but the next season can't be filmed without your help. Dozens of new episodes are planned, but they'll only be brought to life if you make them possible. Your gift by October 31st will bring the truth to students, families, and people around the world. Please use the link in the episode description below to give today.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So what I'm doing is that I'm taking a what is a relatively highly technical scientific talk about a fundamental problem that we have in measurements. And I just add some of my amateur philosophy in it. So I have a minor in philosophy and my dad was a philosopher. So I think the amateur works well. So that you try to understand what are the fundamental challenges that we're facing in the life sciences, particularly with measurements. But what I want to do first is just set up the stage. Fundamentally, so science is about the history of modes. So science, despite of what people, they have their science of life matters, science is real. Science is not real. Science, what it is the development of models that are fundamentally changing, and some of them are long-standing models, because currently the observations that we have and the mathematical framework cannot contradict them. But there's always the possibility in the long term that there might be some fundamental changes on the things that we believe they're real, like the lipid layer, the laws of thermodynamics, in a long time scale where they're going to be changing. Well, the way science advances, and is where the chemistry and the physics have been leading and not the life sciences, is actually that, you know, useful models provide better science, but what drives the development of useful models? If you look at the history of physics, you have a perfect example. So we have the heliocentric model of the universe, where we have the Earth in the center of the universe, and then the Sun and the Moon just going around it. And it comes from Aristotle, the model, then Copernicus established it in stone, the heavens are immutable. But Tycho Brahe, so what he did is that he started to do systematic measurements of the movements of the planets and the stars. And he started to realize that something wasn't fundamentally working with the movements in the way they were described with the current models. Unfortunately, he didn't have the mathematical framework to understand the theory. And that's when Kepler comes in. So he started to discover that these geometrical forms, that actually the movements of the planets, they can be described for parabolic movements that provide a potential explanation, thanks to the detailed measurements that were carried by Brahe, that then allow in the long term. Kepler didn't have the time to do it. He put the parabolic laws, but never did the actual mathematics. It was Newton who actually then put all the framework, the mathematical framework, that makes the movement of the planets into what they appear laws of the movement of the planets. So if it wouldn't be for very precise measurements, we wouldn't be able to create better models to describe reality. So from my reductionistic point of view, good science boils down to good measurements. And if we're unable to advance the science of measurements, then we're not going to be able to produce good models in the long term. And the science of measurement is a combination, so because I'm a mathematician, I don't develop instruments. So for me, it's a combination of a philosophical, mathematical, and then a thought process exercise on how to build better frameworks to do measurements. Why the time is right for the life sciences? The time is right for the life scientists, because based on the talks that you have seen so far, for the first time in the history of the life sciences, We're starting to systematically quantify living phenomena that we couldn't do before until recently, and we're not talking about long time ago, 100 years ago. People were going with lab notebooks, observing the human body and nature, and making descriptions that were primary descriptive factors that were drawn on a notebook, that beautiful descriptions of the phenomenon, either by graphs or by words, that allows to gain an understanding of how the living form would operate and interact with the environment. But those are verbal models that they are incredibly difficult to then recreate into mathematical laws that allow us to have more precise models in the sense of what physics and chemistry they have. So my goal as a scientist is trying to do that. So as a life scientist, I'm very interested to see if we can figure out how we can continuously be observing the living systems and start to make precise measurements for understanding better, making models that allow us to have living organisms and understand the living organisms in a more precise manner. And of course, if you do that in medicine, you can do good medicine. So that's the whole goal of what my research proposed. And you know what I decided to do early on in my career, because the models were well established, they were over 100 years old, was working with enzyme kinetics. And I only did it because it was established and potentially a theory that I could check to the core, because, you know, 100-year-old theory that people still be using today is ripe for actually another theoretician to come and check it if you find where the fundamental flaws they are. But at the same time, you'll find enzymes very exciting because they're the spice of life. And just to give you an idea of why they're the spice of life, enzymes exist in living systems in two ways. They can exist as proteins or they can exist as RNA molecules that they have the capacity to serve as enzymes. What enzymes they do? Enzymes, what they do is that they accelerate the normal chemistry that would happen in our bodies. But instead of happening over a period of 100 years, the dog is barking. It's coming after me and I need to run because I don't want to be beaten by the dog. If I don't have enzymes, the reaction that would catalyze everything that I physiologically need to be active and run might take close to 40 years without the enzymes. With enzymes, it happens like that. They are accelerating the normal chemistry so that living forms can live within the time scale that make us who we are. Otherwise, we will be eternal creatures, but we cannot be eternal creatures. So that's what enzymes they do. And if you take, for example, the typical enzymes, so you can do calculations, I like to do calculations all the time. So the typical enzyme that is a protein base, you have 200 amino acids in the typical average size of an enzyme. And we have 20 amino acids. When you take 20 to the power of 200, you have more atoms. You have more enzymes, actually, than the total atoms of the universe. Life is so rich that actually the basic molecule that allows to accelerate the reaction that makes us living, you can create more enzymes than atoms in the universe if you just play the random game. Of course, there are physical constraints of what amino acids can be next to each other, how they can configure, but the number is staggering. And that's why living forms are so rich. Because if you play the enzymatic game to deal with the chemistry, you have almost an infinite size of possibilities. So now, how do we measure enzymes? So how do we know that an enzyme is being effective for a living being? So the data that we use comes from a physician scientist, Maud Menten. He was actually the first physician scientist coming from Germany, because in Europe she couldn't be educated. She went to Canada to get her MD, PhD. And she was working with Michaelis, who was a very famous chemist at the time. And they were trying to solve a fundamental problem that we have in enzyme kinetics. In enzyme kinetics, when you're doing the reaction, you're combining an enzyme with a substrate. And when you combine the enzyme with a substrate, you give rise to a product. And then when you have in chemistry the combination of two chemical components, you have what is called a second-order reaction. There's a law of the second-order reactions. Enzymes were pioneering that law. somehow you couldn't explain with the current mathematics how answers would operate because something was failing with the law. And they came with a creative idea, and there's a history, other people as well intervene, that if you put an intermediate complex, if there is somewhere in the middle between the enzyme combining with the software, giving rise to that intermediate state, and then they split and they form an enzyme and a product, then you can explain with the mathematics that currently we know the chemical reactions that drive the catalytic chemical reactions by enzymes. And then they came with the idea, because the mathematics is so complex, they simplify all the mathematical equations by making a series of assumptions and coming with this velocity equation. Oops, I don't know what I did there. Just open again the presentation mode. My apologies. So what they did is that so they came with this approximation far away.
Petering out.
Let's see.
There we are. So they came with this equation here that is called the velocity equation. It's a simplified equation that actually is measuring an artifact. It's a mathematical artifact. In reality, when we observe chemical reactions, we can only observe the change of the concentrations. We look at the software concentration depleting in time because it's being converted into a product. Or we can see the product concentration increasing in time because the substrate is being transformed. But the mathematics didn't allow them actually to calculate the integral for looking at neither the depletion nor the formation. What they were able to do was the velocity, which is the derivative of that change of the product concentration or the substrate depletion. And they came with that equation that allows to do experiments, but the experiments are incredibly time consuming in the laboratory to do the calculations. And the equation, so very simply, what it is that you have a limiting rate, is that B, is the asymptote in there, and half of that size, when you have the half of the maximum velocity, the concentration there is what is called the Michaelis constant. That Michaelis constant is used for absolutely everything in medical physiology and biochemistry. We understand how we operate because we're able to measure that physical constant for every single enzyme catalyzed reaction, from signaling pathways, from ligand receptor dynamics, that is a slightly different name for metabolic pathways. It's a very fundamental constant when it comes into biochemistry. And well, the initial rates are difficult to calculate, but because it was the only way that the mathematics worked, people are taking a very painful step. How do they work? Just to give you an idea. So you take the enzyme and the substrate, you shake it up. And then when you shake it up, you wait until all the bubbles come off. And then you look at how the concentration of the substrate or the product is being formed, and you calculate the slope of that. So that gives you one point of velocity. Then you add more substrate, you increase the substrate concentration, add the same amount of enzyme, shake it up, wait a few seconds, and then you determine again the slope of the changes. And you have to do that at least 13 to 30 times to actually calculate that cure and do a good parameter estimation. It's an incredibly time-consuming approach, but actually works. So that's what people have been doing for over a century. You know, a few years ago, so we came with a slightly different approach, where actually we discovered a universal integral for the Michaelis equation that allows you with only one shakeup to determine either the product concentration or the substrate depletion with a single measurement. You have to do only one experiment. You can calculate all the parameters. It revolutionized because at the time it would take you an entire morning to do the calculation of a Michaelis constant. Now you do it literally in a few seconds. So it changed completely the dynamic, and that's the Snell-Mendoza equation. But there are two ways that people these days they do the measurements. Either they use the Snell-Mendoza equation and they think that I'm dead, where they're using that literally, so, or they use the Michaelis-Menten equation, because of course Michaelis and Menten are there. So that's the inference that people are doing. It's not very logical, but. That's the way that the fundamental parameters are measured these days. The problem is the following. And I told you, this is a fundamental concept that people use on a daily basis. But there is a fundamental problem that if you start to look at the biomedical science literature, there are people that are scandalized about, I take a scientific paper, and then I start to read the scientific paper, and I'm unable to actually replicate the same results. Somehow there is something lost in translation that when my colleagues are doing their experiment and they report it, unintentionally, I can assure you that, unintentionally, most of the time, they're not reporting the microscopic details that are absolutely essential on the reporting approach for reproducing the data and the experimental result they obtain. In other occasions, people are not using the right statistics. In other occasions, people are not actually doing sufficient replicas. It's a combination of factors. But in the case of the measurements, and I'm going to illustrate you very quickly, that's one fundamental problem. People are not reporting everything that we need to know to replicate the experiment. So, and what I want to do to set up the stage is explaining the three R's that people confuse all the time, including John Ioannidis, who actually just raised the alarm in science about the reproducibility crisis. And you know, the reproducibility crisis is a platonic problem. It's not a real problem, it's platonic. And at the end of the talk, I explain why. So repeatability, replicability, and then reproducibility. And I have a good paper that actually explains that, but it's for the mathematical sciences. Repeatability. Repeatability means that the same thing with the same methodology approach, they carry the experiment and they can obtain the same result. Imagine that I have somebody in my research group. Imagine that my research group is experimental. I take person A from my research group. They follow the protocol that we have. They calculate the measurement and they say the value is 10. And then I have person B in my group. And I ask them to follow the same protocol. And because we are in constant communication in the group and we're looking at each other, this person B obtains the same measurement. And then roughly, well, it's not 10 because there is experimental noise, but it's close to that. If it's close to that, the variability is close to that, we say that the experiment is repeatable. Now, replicability is different teams, the same approach. Now, I publish my scientific paper with a methodology to measure my enzyme catalyzed reaction. And then I have somebody else reading the paper and then follow step by step the recipe. And if the reporting of my experiment is well done, and the laws of physics and thermodynamics and the mathematical approaches all work, then they should be able to obtain a replicable result. A result that when you do the measurement, the variability, the standard deviation is relatively low. Now, reproducibility is different team, different methodological setup. You would like to measure my height. You can measure it with a measuring tape, with a laser. And there can be two people using a different approach. If you use the laser to measure my height, the measuring tape, or any other mechanism in your hands, are you going to be obtaining the same result? If you do, then what you have is a reproducible experiment. In science, the gold standard of science is not reproducibility. The gold standard of science is replicability. It's having people following exactly the same methodology and then be able to obtain the same results. And we'll discuss, you know, reproducibility slightly later when I give you the overview of how complicated measurements are. So now, is there a replicability and a reproducibility crisis in enzyme kinetics? Let me just tell you, we have lots of databases with numbers in science, and in the biomedical science are becoming more common. Brenda is the largest database with Michaelis constants and all constants of enzyme catalyzed reactions in the world. It has been on the making for over 25 years. If you don't find a number there, the number doesn't exist. You need to measure it. That's the way it operates in biochemistry. Well, if you take the same enzyme and the same software, so which is what I have done in here, for the same organism, for the same human being, this is a variability that you find on the reported values in the literature. And it's not a first assessment because enzyme catalyzed reactions depend from many other things. But you observe a large variability. And let me just explain you the graph. What I have here is a frequency distribution. And on the x-axis, what I have is the power of the error, is the log of the measurement. So if my constant is equal to 10, you know, the log of what is 1. If it's 100, the log of that is 2. And it keeps going on that way. That variability, so it looks like pretty large. And you know, when I show that to my experimental colleagues, they thought it's not that bad. And then I showed them the next graph, which is a graph where now we actually take in the database the measurements with the same enzyme, the same software, the same organism, and now we constrain all the physical measurements of the experiment to the maximum temperature, pH, enzyme purity, everything that we can think of. And we still observe a variability. And the variability, if you look into the extremes, is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 orders of magnitudes. So when I went to the first medical conference, a pharmacological conference, and explained that, somebody told me, Santiago, it's not that bad. It's like, for example, I put my GPS, and instead of the GPS taking me to my home, it's taking me to a supermarket. And I said, oh, gosh, no. So what I decided to do was actually physically illustrating the nature of the problem. So and I did it with the help of a postdoctoral fellow. So imagine that I take the Uber driver, puts in the GPS, the DCA airport where I need to go tomorrow after the conference is over. The driver puts it on, it's going to commit the typical error that would go from this bar to the other one. Instead of taking me to the DCA airport, I'm going to end up in St. Louis, Missouri. So it's a big problem. So if I keep moving on, then it would be twice around the Earth. And then if I keep moving on, it's from Earth to Mars. And if I go to the extreme, it's from Earth to Jupiter. This is the state of the art of the physical constant that your physicians are using for determining the drug targets. Of course, you know, you look at the distribution. It's in the safe space of St. Louis, Missouri. So which explains when you go to your physician and you sign the form, all physicians, when you sign, when you go to a surgeon or you go to a major medical procedure, like, so I was at the leadership of a medical school, I know that because I know what the lawyers wrote. Medicine is not a science. We cannot guarantee results. We cannot guarantee results because that's the state of the medicine these days. And it's a state actually of the physical measurements that we're doing in the laboratory. What's the problem? So what is the, and you know, and again, this is a database, maybe the database wasn't right. What we decided to do, let's study this problem systematically. And you know, what we did is we did something more radical that we have been working over the last 7 years. I have my research group members and myself, and this is generations now of group members, that were reading every single paper in the literature and actually collecting the data in a new database with colleagues in Germany that are developing a database that is actually more clean, much more clean than Brenda. And we're trying to figure out if we can reduce that level of uncertainty and do the measurements better. And, you know, we took that database, which is BioArchive, and we did the analysis of, you know, 28,000 papers, 28,561 papers. Read them all. So this was a huge team effort. We have collected all the scientific data. We have tabulated. We put them all together, and if you collect them all, so regardless of the enzyme and the software, you have a normal distribution in here, which is very good because it means that the data is well measured. And if you do pair comparison between one measurement done by one scientist in one laboratory in one part of the planet and another one, you see that distribution that is a cloud. That's the three-dimensional representation from the top of the normal distribution. Beautiful. It means that, you know, we can analyze this data with normal statistics because it's normal. And when we decide to do it, this is, you know, part of the teamwork, we analyze in the same enzyme, the same software, measured by a number of groups around the world. And then we started to look at how enzyme classes they would vary. And I'm going only to focus on the first one. So what we did is that we did a careful filtering of the data. We decided to take same enzyme, same software, and the same organism. And we end up from the 28,000, 26,000, we end up having 6,000 measurements. And they come from 1,200 groups. So groups have actually published the same data again elsewhere, a reanalysis of the data. So we have confirmation that some groups have done that. And then we decide from the reporting, well, how good the reporting is. And we took same enzyme, same substance, same organism, the same buffer, the same pH, the same temperature, the same enzyme purity. And we end up having from the 20-something, roughly 10% of the data was actually almost perfect to do the calculations. And they were done by 829 groups. And what I did was analyze. Actually, if I take one group that has done them exactly the same measurement, following the same protocol, and compare the difference with another group. And we did that by just doing this plot where we have group A at random chosen from the data set and compare it with another group. If the replication is perfect, they should be following the line. And you can see they're following the line, but there's some variability. The variability is not that large because when you look at the correlation value, it's around 0.8. In biology, in life sciences, a 0.8 correlation value is really damn good. Fantastic. So living systems do not follow lines very well most of the time. And you can see that there's a constraint in the noise between having only same enzyme, same substrate, same organism, and then having all the experimental conditions controlled. Actually, the data is compressing. And we did a mathematical calculation of what is the level of noise, how many order of magnitudes the error is. And it's not that bad. It's not 4 orders of magnitudes. Already it's 2 orders of magnitudes. The typical error that we have in the literature, pharmacological literature, biochemical literature, people studying, you know, biochemistry in general, when they measure a this physical constant, the Michaelis constant, it's an error of 2 orders of magnitudes, which is, you know, you just have to multiply. Somebody measures 1, the other one has measured 100. So it is bad, but it's not as terrible as we originally thought it would be. So the question is where the variability lies. What's the fundamental problem that scientists are committing that they don't understand why they cannot do measurements very well? And you know, what we decide to do, let's look at the literature and find out where the errors are committed. So I'm a member of an international commission that actually is dedicated to the standardization of the enzyme catalyzed measurements. This commission has been in existence for 15 years, and now I think it's 16 or 17. I'm getting older, so because I don't remember anymore when we created. It's called the Standard Commission. And what we have done is that all the top scientists in this academic discipline, we decided to have a reporting guideline that if you publish your paper, you should be using a table that we provide you. And if technically, if you use a table, it hasn't been experimentally proven, by the way. My colleagues, who are the experimentalists, they have never tested if that table is right. So as a theoretician, I have come to question the table. And it's part of the process that we're talking today. They put the table together. And they do reporting. And we say, well, let's look at the literature and find out in the top journals, Science, Nature, Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, JACS, which is a top chemistry journal, are they scientists when they report an enzyme catalyzed measurement? They're reporting the fundamental things that we need to know. And this is state of the art. 63% of the groups are missing the enzyme concentration when they report the experimental data. 63%. If you don't know how much enzyme you put, you have no idea anything about the velocity. Because the velocity is correlated with the enzyme concentration. And you know how quickly the reaction is going to happen depends on how much enzyme. You add a lot of enzyme, you saturate the system, and that substance is becoming product very quickly. 63% of the groups are going to do that. 20%. They report numbers. They don't tell you if they are macromolar, millimolar, they're measuring with densities, if they're measuring with lumen values. Impossible to know what numbers they use. Then you look at 40%, they measure something, they don't tell you what biochemical reaction they use to assume the mathematical model. And the same score. You know, like for example, 5% of the group, they report room temperature. You know, let me tell you, room temperature where I grew up in Caracas, Venezuela, Caribbean, tropical, is not the room temperature from New Hampshire, Hanover, where, you know, in the summer, so we're lucky if we hit 75 one day. So it's a completely different exercise. Well, this one fundamental problem, the standard guideline that exists, people are not following. And as a consequence, it's very difficult to actually reproduce the results, and that's one source of the variability. And you know, we're trying now to launch, you know, a round-robin experiment where we're going to have the same experimental groups trying to see if we can replicate each other's experiments. And you know, we're launching the experiment in September. But the other thing is that there is an ill-posed problem on the measurements that I don't think experimental scientists fully grasp. Let's see if I'm on time. So you have to signal me if I'm talking too much. Measurements. So, you know, human beings, and this is Thomistic, this is Platonic, we're trapped in our human body. We're trapped in our senses. We're not spiritual beings that actually can observe the objects just perfectly well. We're fully dependent on the allegory of the game. The real objects, if they exist, or we might be living in a dream, the real objects, if they exist, they're reflected with instrumentation in the world. And the instrumentation is providing you a specific sense of what that instrument does. The instrument can be doing a smell. The instrument can be doing touch. The instrument can be doing eye. We don't know what the instrument does. The instruments, all the chemical instruments, all physical instruments that we use inside, they're an extension of our human body. They're just extending what our eyes, our senses cannot see. And each instrument, what it's going to be doing is providing a reflection of the reality from the angle of that instrument. It's an imperfect measurement. And that's what we are doing all the time. So if you use a specific instrument, you're observing just one aspect of the phenomenon. So the problem that you have is, you know, nil ex in intellectu in su prius fuere sensu, this is Thomistic now, that, you know, we're in a blank slate. Our minds, you know, they're just trapped on a blank slate that needs to be feeding by what we can observe. And the instruments that allow us to do that. And it is through that process of abstraction that we measure something, and then we start to figure out how all combined together makes sense, is where scientists can convert the physical measurements into models. But that phenomenon has some substantial problems that if you think more carefully on how we do measurement, there are things that we are not calling into question that sometimes are problematic. Let me just give you, for example, two fundamental challenges that I think are currently happening with instant Cantor reactions. The two primary sources of variability in this hypothesis of Mydrow is that you have two fundamental problems in instant kinetics. You have what is called the forward problem. I'm going to explain very briefly what is that. Which is, you have an ideal chemical reaction that you imagine in your mind. Michaelis and Menten, the only way that they could explain that the reaction would happen, and now we have physical evidence, in fact, with very sophisticated instrumentation, that the complex actually exists physically. They put the complex in there. And then when we write the differential equations to describe how that law works, then get the complex. We cannot solve it. We need to actually do a mathematical approximation. All the equations that we use for measurements, all the equations, I think in science there is no single equation that actually is not the result of an approximation. And most of the experimental scientists, they have no idea what approximations are used for actually deriving the equations. That's the forward modeling problem. We need to understand under what conditions the mathematical equations that we use for the measurements are valid. And most of the time, it's mysterious. So I've spent 25 years of my life only figuring out when the approximation that Michaelis Menten made and the one that I made, they're valid. 25 years of hard work. And the other problem is that once you use that approximation is a draw of the shadow on the cake. It's that drawing of the shadow of the cake, when I do the measurement, a reflection of what actually happens in reality, of the real thing. That's what we call the inverse mathematical problem. And there are two fundamental problems that are incredibly difficult for understanding, and most of the experimental scientists, in my opinion, they don't fully grasp it. So now, let me just talk about the forward and the inverse problem in more detail. So the forward problem is that we take the real reaction, and again, real here, we need to make the assumption that so far everyone agrees that reality looks like enzyme plus substrate gives you the complex, and the complex gives you the enzyme and the product. Could be much more complicated than that. And in fact, it's much more complicated than that. We just do that simple model because the mathematics is so complex that otherwise we wouldn't be able to do any measurements. And then we do that simplification for observing reactions with a simplified model. We develop the mathematical model for the real reaction. Then we derive simple equations or algorithms to measure the parameters. And we need to understand when those modes are valid. So now, that takes a lot of mathematics. So you can read some of my papers that are really, really boring. So lots of mathematics and you know, a foreign language for the majority, and even sometimes for myself. I just work with very bright people. But let me just give you one of the several epistemological assumptions that we need to make to actually start to do measurements in the natural sciences. The first is that, you know, if we think that that's a reaction, we need to assume that it's real. And again, it's real within a series of constraints. For example, when you do what is called a steady-state experiment, you take the enzyme, the software, you check that off, and you wait for a few minutes. That reaction in there generally is a good representation of what you measure. But for example, if you're doing the experiments on instruments where you can measure the enzyme, the software very, very quick, that reaction is not any more valid. You need to add multiple complexes into the system because it's so rapid, the mixture between the enzyme and the software, that then what you start to observe is intermediate complexes before you measure the problem. So every time you decide to set up a model, you are constrained by the kind of experiments that you can do with that model. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that you need to describe that reaction in mathematical terms. And there are somebody who makes a living of doing mathematical descriptions of phenomena. There are hundreds of ways of doing that. You can do it with ordinary differential equations. You can do it with partial differential equations. You can do it with delayed differential equations. Very few people actually don't know what they are. In fact, the first model of enzyme kinetics, it was a delayed differential equation model that assumed that something happened in the middle. Nobody knew if it was a complex. But they assumed that there was a delay between the software being formed in the product. It's an historical artifact. The mathematical equation tells you that the product is the historical creation of something that happens in the past. Perfect example of how to explain it. My children are an historical artifact of myself. There's a continuous of Santiago Schnellas develops as human beings and then becomes a reproductive artist, finds the right woman, marries, and then they have children. So I can describe Santiago Schnellas multiple complexes being changing until then he reproduces with a continuous system of ordinary differential equations. Or I can describe Santiago Schnell as a delayed differential equation. I'm born 25 years later, so it was almost 28. The first child is born. A delay. Very simple. Only one equation. Something that actually would simplify 28 years of my biological, physiological, and sociological evolution. You can describe that phenomenon. And you know, surprisingly, most of those mathematical descriptions, they converge. They converge perfectly well. They observe the phenomenon from different perspectives, and all of them, they can give you the same reality. So when sometimes I hear experimental scientists at the loss of, yes, the loss of that, because you describe with that mathematical term, you can find an alternative mathematical reality that actually can describe the same phenomenon. And in chemical kinetics, we have described chemical kinetics in hundreds of different ways. Even we now describe it with agents, with computational agents. And it tends to converge sometimes to the same result, which talks a little bit about revelation in this case. But anyway, so then you have to make assumptions to select the right model. And finally, the model has to be tractable from the experimental point of view. To make it tractable, you do a lot of approximations. Very quickly, how do you do the approximation? In the majority of the cases for physical measurements, what you do is that you have a very complex system of differential equations. You tend to have, in chemistry, one for each chemical species that is interacting. You have four in the Michaelis-Menten reaction. You have four differential equations. Non-linear, you cannot solve them. Then what you do is that you find a small parameter that allows you to cancel as many equations as you can. And then once you do that, you come with, instead of having four differential equations, you have one differential equation, and then everything is a constant. And that allows you to derive the Michaelis-Menten equation. The problem is that what is less than one? Much less than one is 0.0001, 0.1, It's a fundamental problem that, you know, as well in mathematics we have. We're doing all these perturbation approaches for dynamic approximations. But I want to say, is order epsilon. What it means to be order epsilon. The reality is that, you know, everyone does their approximation slightly different, and the accuracy of the approximation changes according to the order. And when we study the approximation, so it's a long story short, we discover that there can be multiple epsilons. And, you know, each one of them would make the equation valid under a different set of experimental conditions. That's the take-home message. So over the last 25 years, we discovered there are multiple ways to do the reductions by identifying different small parameters. And we even came with a definition of a small parameter that is not dependent on being much less than one, but we make it to the limit to zero, which mathematically is much more precise. And, you know, we end up discovering that, and, you know, it's very good because now we believe that we know when the equation should be used appropriately under experimental conditions. And again, so you can have no substrate, fast substrate, and depending on where you are with the substrate and some concentration, you can use one equation with a different epsilon, another equation with a different epsilon, another equation with a different epsilon. And it's just a small region where some of them are not valid at all. So the other thing is that with it is that, you know, we end up finding the ultimate necessary condition by negating all the problems. And if you are interested in mathematics, you can look at that, but this is not the core of the talk. So we have the conditions. So now, if we have the conditions for the validity and we take the equation, can we recover the real physical parameters? The parameters that if the reaction exists and is real, and we put it in a molecular simulator, can we recover those parameters? That's a big question that we have now. If we have the right equation, the right set of conditions, we design the experiment right, can we get the right parameters? This is what the inverse problem does. You determine the design of the experiment to measure the parameters. And then you identify the right parameter estimation algorithms to do that. So it's primary statistics and design of experiments, the standardization of design of experiments. The issue is that this is what we call the inverse problem. And to illustrate you how difficult it is, of the problem of the shadows and the K, is that I can show you that shadow in there. And all of you are going to be absolutely convinced that if you measure that, it's going to be a human hand. But then if I reveal what it is, then there is a trick of the objects that, thanks to the reflection of the angles of where the observations were made, the shadow you're observing can have multiple solutions. It might be a hand. We might be just that little rabbit playing games with you. The inverse problem is so complicated that we never have absolute certainty that we can actually measure the real object from the shadows. And, you know, that's a trap that all scientists we have to live on a daily basis. Some of us recognize it. So if you make a living for measuring, I recognize it. Others, they're not aware of it. And it's where, you know, we can make breakthroughs in science in the moment you discover that little trick of the senses. And what we did is that, you know, we tried to figure out if it was a perfect mapping, a mathematical mapping. So you can prove mathematically if you can map the inverse problem. You know, Wayne Strober, who was a brilliant postdoctoral fellow, he's now a faculty member with tenure at the University of Alberta. So he did. He discovered that, you know, the Michaelis-Menten, all chemical kinetic problems, in fact, he came with that conclusion, all chemical kinetic measurements that we can do, they're not inverse. So we're always going to have an error from the forward problem. If we use a forward equation that we derive and we try to estimate the parameters, we're never going to be able to determine uniquely the parameters. We can get close to it, but there's always going to be a significant room for error, which is a huge problem. The second thing is that he did actually the experiment that I described just a few minutes ago to you. He make a molecular simulator where he put enzyme, the substrate, create the complex product and enzyme. That simulator was generating noise. It was like a real experiment. And from there, he actually did the parameter estimation. And, you know, he ended up discovering something very interesting. So that the measurement that actually we recently discovered, and this is, he did this a few years ago, the typical error of two orders of magnitude seems to be real. It's something that actually inherently can happen in this system if you don't control very well for the experimental measurements. But when you do, and you know, he figured out what conditions you actually can carry out the systematic analysis, he discovered that what it was reported in the literature so far, there were five conditions that were essential. And these are the four most critical ones. Everywhere in the literature, you open every single textbook for measuring enzymes, they say that you need to have more software than enzyme to carry the measurement. Fundamentally flawed. That assumption is not real. You need to measure the progress cure of the product formation software. 90% of the reaction, completely false. You only need to measure a small region. That is where the curvature changes the most. And you need to have these 9 points, as well as he discovered that was false. So, you know, with literally 4 points in the region of the maximum curvature, you can do measurements really well. The only thing that he discovered that matches the literature is that when you add an initial software concentration, it has to be in the same order of magnitude that the Michaelis constant. What is the problem with that? We never know the Michaelis constant a priori. It's an ill-posed problem by itself, and that explains why the mapping doesn't exist. Well, we did a little more of work, and this is a technical that we can ignore. It's a replicability challenge, and this is where I'm going to be closing. So our analysis suggests two fundamental problems. One is a problem of reporting. So we don't know whether we're reporting everything that we need to report to have replicable experiments. And nobody has done a systematic experiment, at least in the life sciences. In physics, they do that really well in chemistry. But in the life sciences, they're not doing those experiments. So now we're starting to do that analysis to figure out how we can have those biases on the reporting and the analysis more standardized. But then there's the other point of the Thomistic epistemology that, you know, understanding the essence and the causes often is a gradual process that you have to go back and forth. And generally, scientists, they are not sufficiently patient to go back and forth multiple times to do that, to have a replicable problem. The other problem that we have is the issue of similarity. So the similarity, if you want to have reproducible models that you do a measurement in science with two different instruments and two different approaches, but you're measuring the same phenomenon, if you want to have actually the same number, you need to have unity of knowledge. And unity of knowledge is incredibly complex. I don't know if us, as living beings limited by our senses, we are going to be able ever to actually achieve reproducibility. Because we are trapped on this problem of the shadows and the reflections that they are very, very imperfect. And what it requires is having, you know, a human being that is able to actually have a three-dimensional view of the object and do shadows three-dimensionally, indicate in every single direction to be able to fully grasp it. And so far, the way the sciences operate, that we tend to have reflections only in one direction. Why I'm saying all this? That I'm saying this because, and this is where I close up, and I'm sorry for taking an extra minute. When you start to think about most of the sciences that are weak on measurement, social sciences, ecological sciences, the medical sciences, we don't fully grasp what we're measuring very well. Ontologically, we don't understand what we're measuring. We understand what we measure because we have descriptions of the phenomena. Scientists, they don't know what things are, and they don't know the why of the things. They characterize them, and they know the how. That characterization leads to different things. The only way that I think scientists can advance effectively measurements is to be working very closely with philosophers who can object to all these issues that I have been raising by using the right mathematical model. How do you know that that mathematical model is a better description but not the other one? How do you know that that reflection of reality is a proper one? Do you know that you're measuring the real object or no? So, and how, what is the object that you're describing? You're giving the description, but is that the object? Or is just a secondary aspect of the object? Philosophers are the only ones that are going to be able to help to advance the life sciences in the same way that they help with the physical sciences at the beginning of the previous century. We observe that phenomenon of the accelerated of the physical sciences because physicists were open enough historically to understand that with the help of philosophers, they would be able to transform effectively the way they would be able not only to do measurements, but understanding the physical sciences. You know, that's where I close up. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast.
The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.